This is the Best of Golic and Wingo podcast.
Golic and Wingo here on ESPN Radio. ESPN News, we're presented by Progressive Insurance. All guests joins us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Got a lot of great ones coming up this morning. Bomani Jones going to join us at 7:30 Eastern. Brian Windhorst at 8:30. Booger McFarland at 9 o'clock. Plus, because we've got the NBA starting to ramp back up, zero positive tests again for the NBA inside the bubble yesterday out of 346 tested. Exhibition games are going to start, believe, between the 22nd and the 28th before the actual return on the 30th. So we're starting your NBA preview, reminding you where everybody left off before we entered into quarantine, before we got to the bubble and all this. Give a refresher course there. But we've had the good news of the day. My sister Sydney engaged to her longtime boyfriend, Ben Broniker, so now fiance, Ben Broniker in this. And he pulled it off. Pulled off the proposal really well in this one. You not so much back in the day. We got to relive this the other day. Just give everyone a quick refresher of exactly how badly you botched the proposal to my dear sweet mother.
Yeah, my proposal was horrible. I met Chris, and she lived in Chicago, and I flew to Chicago to see her. But prior to that, I called her before I left and actually said to her over the phone, "I have the ring.
I have the ring. Do you want to see what it looks like?"
I mean, well, this was over the phone, so I knew she couldn't see what it looks like, but I told her I had the ring. Why I did that, I have no idea. So she picked me up at the airport, and we went right to a concert, a Michael Stanley Band concert. Actually, he was opening for Jack Wagner. Now I'm really showing my age. This is in Chicago. Yeah, how about it? This is in Chicago. We were actually in the parking lot before we walked into the concert. She knew I had the ring. I had told her I had the ring. So there was zero anticipation by me of actually surprising her and asking her to marry me. So basically, that's when I said, "You just want to see the ring, you know?" And it was awful.
Every time I cringe.
It was awful. We went in, talked to Michael Stanley and those guys for a little bit, and then we left. We didn't stay for the concert. And the further I got removed from that moment, the more I just thought how horrific that was and what a poor job I did in every aspect that could be.
So Ben pulled it off. My dad
did a great job.
Not so much in this situation. So at Golic and Wingo, we're asking for bad proposal stories all morning. Little teaser here. Stacey Lynn Moon said Civil War reenactment. I figured he was going to ask at the dance. Didn't ask. Kept not asking. Finally, we went for a walk. Dark. No moon. Middle of a field. He asked, then couldn't get the ring off of the string he'd tied it around. It all worked out.
Oh, my gosh.
So, an absolute nightmare on that one. Keep those coming. We will get back to that this morning, as certainly we're talking about my sister getting engaged, your daughter, because, hell, it was a hell of a Monday for us. But the NFL offering the players zero preseason games is what everybody is talking about. What everyone's talking about is brought to you by 303 Touchless Sealant for ultimate protection and shine in no time. 303 Touchless Sealant. So now, for more on that, we welcome in our ESPN NFL insider, Dan Graziano. Dan, good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing well, but that truly is a terrible story. And I don't know, it's depressing. You really should make something up, I think, and tell a false story instead of that one. Because it's got to be a better way.
What I'm trying to do, Dan, is because I thought of that. I thought of lying my way through this. But then I thought, you know what? I'm going to tell the story of a horrible engagement, but we've been married for 33 years.
Yeah,
so,
right.
And I have three, you know, decent kids. So it's kind of worked out. So I guess so I'm going
that
route.
There's some evidence that you really did do it the right way. That's a good point. All right. Well, I take it back then. I apologize.
You know what? Now that we've gotten and settled through that one here, we can proceed forward amicably. So Dan Graziano with us. Dan, you've been as dialed into all of this back and forth between the NFL and the NFLPA in this entire process. And so I'm curious, as you went along here, what seemed like the tougher concession as the NFL has offered the players, as we heard reported yesterday, no preseason games, as well as daily testing through the first two leagues of this. So were these difficult concessions for the NFL after the outpouring of tweets that we saw from the players this weekend?
Yeah, I think it gets back to what we were talking about. If we go back, it was really only like 4 or 5 months. We were talking about CBA talks between these same two groups. And, it's give and take, and it's collective bargaining, and it's negotiation. And, you know, if you cover it like a horse race, then it looks like, oh, somebody gave something just at the end. I think it's been a pretty productive conversation between the two sides that seems to be landing in a good place on the health and safety thing. We'll see what happens with the money. But the big thing as of Sunday, when you saw all those players tweeting about NFL's ignoring its own medical advice, they're talking about this ramp-up period when they get to training camp. They want 21 days of just strength and conditioning, 10 days of non-padded practices before they get into the contact phase. So the players were having a hard time getting the league to agree to that. And the preseason thing is tied up in that, because if you think about it, they were going to play two preseason games. Every time you play a preseason game, that's 3 days where you don't practice, because you don't practice the day before or the day after or the day of the game. So if you want to implement this long ramp-up period, the preseason games are kind of in the way of that when you talk about the overall time they had. So agreeing to the longer ramp-up period, which it seems like the league is doing, and then getting rid of the preseason games, it kind of goes hand in hand. So they've gotten to this point. It hasn't been easy. It's taken longer than a lot of people are comfortable with. And there still is a fight coming over the money, over what happens to the salary cap next year as a result of lost revenue this year and that kind of stuff. So it's always difficult with these two sides. We saw it in baseball. It got painfully difficult there. The players have a union that can fight for their rights. And because of that, they don't have to just take what the NFL gives them. And we get to see behind the curtain sometimes. And it does seem like it's a little bit dicey.
As far as the money, Dan, what's interesting, baseball players weren't stepping on the field until they had that part of it worked out. It seems, or you correct me if I'm wrong, that they're going to kind of work out the financial part along the way, or is that something that has to be done before the 28th?
It has to be done. At least the opt-out portion of it has to be done relatively soon, because if a player decides he doesn't want to go to camp, he wants to opt out of the season, for medical reasons or because he's not comfortable with the setup, with the virus still present, then they're going to have to be able to tell that player, here's what happens to your contract. It's going to toll and just pick up again where we are next year. You're just going to get a year off from it, or it pays this much, and then you have to take this much off the next year. They have to work that part out. But the big picture thing that I was referring to earlier in terms of how much revenue are they going to lose in 2020 as a result of empty stadiums, as a result of, you know, if games do end up having to be canceled at some point, and then how does that affect the salary cap going forward? That may be something that takes a while, because as long as they have the individual opt-out thing in place, they can get on the field without that. So where that lands is going to be a matter of really how many years they decide they want to spread the pain out over. Like, the owners want to take a big hit right now, drop the salary cap next year, and then go right back up to the salary cap growth we've been used to in 2022. And the players are saying, well, big picture maybe, but in terms of the current players, it's really going to affect a lot of guys. A lot of guys are going to get cut. So they would rather spread it out over a number of years, and they're having a negotiation really over basically how many years that ends up being. So that could take a little while, but I think the next thing you'll see is once this is all official, all the stuff that happened last night, I think you'll see an agreement on the opt-out procedures for if a guy, you know, if his doctor tells him you really shouldn't play because you have this and this pre-existing condition, or if he decides that he's just not comfortable playing and he wants to take the year off.
Talking to Dan Graziano, our ESPN NFL insider there. A couple of the big hurdles left to go, but one of the other things that was talked about, a lot of this in addition to the preseason games, was daily testing for the players being a big deal, and they're going to get that for the first 2 weeks, and then after that it's going to potentially adjust depending on that 5% positivity rate threshold. I'm curious, how adjustable do you think that's going to be going forward, especially when the NFL looks over and sees a league like the NBA, who has been going with daily testing in a bubble, having so much success with their process?
The hope is that it'll be something like what we've seen in the NBA, and more specifically, actually, a Major League Baseball, which doesn't have a bubble system, but whose testing numbers last week were very encouraging. They had actually come out with they had released some testing numbers on Friday afternoon, right before I had a conversation with someone on the ownership side in the NFL who referenced that, saying, you know, that tells us a lot, because these are guys that are going home to their families, are interacting with other people away from the facility. And that if those testing numbers can go down, that gives us some encouragement, because that's going to be the situation in the NFL. You're going to continue to hear the NFL and the NFLPA preach to the players and to the team employees and everybody, when you go home, it's on you. If you bring this thing back into a team facility and there's a widespread infection that's going to hurt everybody, it could end up, you know, shutting down the league again. So everyone's going to have to be on their best behavior in terms of how they manage the virus and the ability to transmit it when they're away from the facility. So that's the big question the NFL is facing. They think when they're in their buildings, they're going to be okay because the incredible amount of work that's been done to set the buildings up in terms of, you know, disinfecting them and social distancing and all the stuff that's going to go on from right down to how packages are handled when they're delivered to the facility, to how the cafeterias are set up. They think when you're in the building, you're going to be safe. When you go outside the building, that's when they don't have any way to really track you, and it's on you to make sure that you act in a safe manner and come back without without a high risk of the virus.
And obviously, Dan, numbers play a part here. The more players that are there, the more chance and risk you have of them going home and coming back, the more opportunity, unfortunately, for the coronavirus to be found and or spread. Is the 90-man roster still in place? Is there still a thought of going with less in this? How is that working?
You know, it's funny. That is a question that came up last night, and I realized that we had been focused on that early, and we don't have an answer to yet. So hopefully we figure that out today. I had been told to expect smaller rosters in training camp because of the way the facilities have to be set up in terms of, you know, space between lockers, et cetera. So that is definitely something that's come up. There's been some pushback from coaches and GMs, so I don't know where the number will settle. But I would be surprised if it's 90, probably more like something like in the 70s or 80. And then you will see probably, ironically, larger rosters effectively during the season because the teams are going to have these sort of taxi squads available to them in case a number of guys test positive on a given weekend. So that, I guess that they still haven't – nothing's come out about that, even in all the flurry of news last night. So maybe that's part of what we find out today and tomorrow.
And roster size and flexibility is going to be one thing, but the other part that had still been brought up was flexibility potentially with the schedule. Sean McVay had said that he's skeptical the NFL is going to start on time. Has there been any talk of the possibility of pushing back the start date of the NFL season?
Did McVay say season or training camp? Because I think I'm trying to, because everybody, there's so much flying around. I think he said trade because they're talking about training camp dates right now. There are teams that are trying to talk about when we get guys in and all that kind of stuff. So in terms of the season, I mean, that may be tied to the start of training camp because, you know, the longer that it would get pushed back, then the longer they might have to push back the start of the season. But if they're able to start camp in the next couple of weeks and they're able to get through camp without a huge spike in positive cases and people contracting the virus, then I think the expectation is they will be able to start the season on time. I know there are coaches that are concerned about not having enough time to get ready, but the message is going to continue to be, hey, it's not a normal year. You have to adjust. I was texting with one head coach the other night saying, boy, this is going to be something. And he said, look, the best prepared teams are going to be the ones that win. And all I'm waiting for is the rules so they can tell me how to build my training camp schedule around those. I think that's the right mentality. And the more coaches that take that approach, I think the better that they'll be.
Yeah, his quote was, something about it tells me maybe there's a chance things get moved back, and that's what's weird because you want to make sure, hey, if we're going, we're ready to roll, we're locked
in. It was in reference to training camp.
But if training camp gets pushed back enough, that certainly could go to the season. All right,
yeah, exactly.
Real quick, Dan, I want to ask, away from the health and safety of players, which is the most important thing, I have to ask this question because I read it and I just went, huh? Patrick Mahomes signed that 12-year deal or 10-year extension and could make over $500 million. And after he signed it, he texts Chris Jones, but this was before Chris Jones got his deal done. He texts Chris Jones and said, let's get this thing done. I left some money on the table for you. What? I mean, did Patrick Mahomes leave money on the table in this deal?
Yeah, he did. I mean, he didn't max out. I mean, like, first of all, you're 24 years old and you're as good as he is. You're going to give your team 12 years of control over your income. I think that's kind of nuts. But as great as the numbers sound, you know, the full guarantee at signing is $63 million thereabouts. The signing bonus was $10 million. I mean, Russell Wilson's signing bonus was $65 million when he signed his contract last year. I mean, the numbers sound great, and they get huge toward the end, but over the first 5 years, it's $183 million. I mean, it's a lot of money, but it's not, you know, it's not a lot more on average than Russell Wilson makes. So, you know, he didn't in any way that affects the Chiefs' short-term budgeting blow out the budget. By the time Chris Jones needs another contract, Patrick Mahomes will not have cost the Chiefs a crazy amount of money. It's the second half of that contract where the numbers get insane. And at that point, I think, you know, it probably won't be the highest paid quarterback number anymore. So he did leave some on the bone. He did for Chris Jones. And I think that's why the deal got done. There were 2 years left on Patrick Mahomes' contract. If the Chiefs were going to do a deal now, it was going to be one that helped them. And I think that's what we saw.
Prayers up for Patrick on that one.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. The first world problems, right? Like, yeah, only 183 in 5 years. Yeah.
Follow him on Twitter at Dan Graziano, ESPN. He's been nails on everything surrounding this ramp up back to the NFL season. Dan, thanks, we appreciate Dan. The time.
Thank you, guys.
You know, I knew from the money side it was, but I figured people wanted to hear Dan explain it. And just that line. He signed for over $400 million, and I left some money on the table for you.
Must be nice. Golic and Wingo is brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless. Cover all your bases with Straight Talk Wireless. Get the same networks as the big carriers, only pay up to 50% less, and get the unlimited plan with 25 gigs of high-speed data, then 2G, for just $45 a month, only at Walmart. Savings may vary. See terms and conditions at straighttalk.com. It is Golic and Wingo, presented by Progressive Insurance. All guests like Dan Graziano join us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. So we've got all that going on in the world of professional sports, and
right.
It's been a very different world, but one that seems to be progressing in the right direction. This is sort of the exact opposite out of college football. Yesterday, we talked so much about the need for players to start to voice their opinions and the use of social media in that. I think the importance of that got underscored a lot more with some news yesterday out of Iowa. We're going to have Bomani Jones on in a little under an hour now to talk some about those power dynamics that have been at play here. But a Kansas City law firm was hired by Iowa, currently investigating the allegations that were made by former Iowa football players that we saw this summer against their former strength coach now,
right.
Some of the other coaches on the staff. But Kirk Ferentz's name has, you know, it was
him
under,
and his son, yes.
His son's name was brought up. Kirk Ferentz was just brought under fire because he's the head of that program. Well, HawkeyeNation.com obtained a document that gave clear indications that greater change was needed some time ago here. There was a diversity task force comprised of 9 University of Iowa employees who conducted interviews in the fall of 2018 and created a 9-page report outlining some of the very same complaints that we heard this summer about the lack of diversity within the program, the treatment of African-American players relative to their white counterparts, and just in general, the culture that had been brought up there. And this was a quote from last week of Kirk Ferentz, because those findings had come up and they had made some small cosmetic changes to that. But here was the quote from Kirk Ferentz talking about the task force findings in 2019, which in the changes included, among other things, allowing players to wear hats and earrings inside of the facility. He said, quote, "They appeared in my mind to be significant, the changes. And I think players were happy with the changes we made. I think we did what we did was good. I'll give you full disclosure on this. I dropped the ball because I talked to the group about coming back for a follow-up meeting, either the bye week or right after the season. And in December, I failed to do that." So you look at this situation now and say, all right, for like Iowa was given word internally through this that they had issues relative to all the problems that we heard players past and present voice for the Hawkeyes.
And it wasn't all just about wearing hats and being able to have your earrings in.
No, even I can say, even though those tend to be racially coded things when their rules put in, it was a lot more than that. And this report had a lot more than that in there, which is to say they knew about this in their own building. And it was so important to everybody involved that they made those one or two tweaks and then forgot to address it.
They tried to handle this thing internally. They did a few cosmetic things to handle it internally, and then they just let it go. Right? That's basically what happened.
And they forgot about it until they were pressed from the outside. And that to me was the reminder of this, of why social media, and Dad, I know this is the conversation you and I have had a lot about airing things out on social media like this.
Yes.
This is why, especially for college players, that is a weapon going forward. And it's one that, by the way, at Iowa, for a long time, their social media policy was you had none. You didn't tweet. You weren't on there. You had no recourse like this. And now you see any meaningful change that was going to come after this. And we've seen the committee that's going to be headed up by Mike Daniels and some other former players on this. More things being pushed for on this, including Chris. I mean, Chris Doyle, their strength coach,
right,
was fired in all this. Now he got a healthy severance package.
Yes, he did.
That.
And his son was on the team, and he transferred away.
But it underscores the importance of players having this weapon to make sure that their voice is heard, because if they go through the normal protocols, we saw an example of what happens.
It's one of the many things I learn over the changing times and what becomes popular out there. And I do see that, because I see what things, especially that I went through, and even after me, things that happen that just get buried, that get talked about internally, that say, yeah, we see, and then we'll take care of it. We'll pat you on the back, head out the door, and then basically it disappears, unless it's now brought up and everybody can kind of see what's going on. The curtain is pulled away. I do see the benefit of that.
Golic and Wingo.
And Wingo.
Mm-hmm. Trey Wingo and Mike Golic Sr.
Our next guest, you can hear him, the Right Time podcast with Bomani Jones. You can also see him on Highly Questionable and among a number of other ESPN platforms. Bomani, good morning. How you doing?
Good, man. How about you?
Good.
We're good. No complaints here, Bo. So for those who don't know and are not as used to this, Bomani Jones around the sport of college football is as knowledgeable and well-versed as anyone you're going to come across in here, even though inexplicably we don't use him as much in this capacity at ESPN. But Bomani, I wanted to ask you, yesterday we got news out of Iowa, a document uncovered that a diversity task force in Iowa with a number of staffers around that athletic department had put together a document and presented it to Iowa in early 2019, and specifically the football team, documenting and outlining a lot of the same instances and accusations of the culture around there that made it difficult for black people to feel comfortable, and instances that just seem, you know, out and out racist in a lot of senses. And so I guess I would ask, how did all of us miss this so badly the first time around when we went through this about a month ago with the press conference after the very public statements from former and current players on social media?
Well, I think we missed it the first time because we're so inclined to give people like Kirk Ferentz the benefit of the doubt, that all he really had to do was sit in there in that first press conference and be like, ooh, wow, my bad. I didn't know. We were like, okay, well, Kirk didn't know. And then we come to find out, we got paperwork that Kirk did, in fact, know what was going on, and apparently seemed to believe that just by letting dudes wear earrings and hoodies that everything would be fixed. Like, that was what he thought. He was like, man, you know, we just had to let them wear the earrings, so I thought that everything there was okay. And it clearly was not. And it really bothered me when I saw that there had been a report previously, because Ferentz basically got up at that press conference and lied to everybody when he had it a couple months ago, because he acted so shocked that all these players would have these feelings and then share them, when in reality, he knew that they had these feelings. In fact, he would have been better served if he had gotten up at that press conference a couple months ago and said, yes, we knew that the players felt this way. We looked into this and we started doing some things, but we got some more steps to take. Instead, he just acted like, whoa, really? This is what's going on? And it happened, and it slid in part because media, by and large, doesn't want to dig into these things. You got to send a shout-out to the guys at Hawkeye Nation, because they put in the Freedom of Information Act request to find all of this stuff out. But otherwise, major media would just let this slide.
And he admitted, Kirk Ferentz, that he dropped the ball on not having a follow-up meeting with his players, which really – and Bomani, for me, it has been a learning experience over the years because of my age, going from, hey, you keep a lot of stuff in-house, you take care of your problems, to seeing everything on social media that players are able to bring out now, and how things can just be swept under the rug and kept under the rug if it isn't brought out by the players. And I've really – seen that come to light, at least over the last couple of years, and players having the power now in college to do what they're doing. Where do you think this leads for Kirk Ferentz? Can what he's saying now be enough of, okay, everything's going to be okay there now?
Yeah, he'll be fine as long as they like win a halfway decent number of games this year. One thing I think we've all learned about when people get fired, the number one reason that you get fired is because your boss wants to fire you. It doesn't really have that much to do with actual performance or actual malfeasance. Do they want to fire you? And they, for whatever reason, do not want to fire him at Iowa. They have an affection for Ferentz that I find to be a little bit bizarre, because his predecessor, Hayden Fry, that was like a legitimately great coach and, from what I've read, great man. You know, like this, like he was the what we want to make college football coaches. Hayden Fry seemed to fit in line with that. Ferentz, not so much. Now, granted, Ferentz had that run in his first decade on that job where I want to say he had something like three top 10 seasons, which Iowa hadn't seen success in that way. And so you get addicted to it. And so you kind of keep riding it out. But I think you made an interesting point about believing that you handle these things in-house, because apparently at most of these schools, that's what the guys have tried to do first, is to handle things in-house. And that just doesn't seem to work. Like, shame seems to be the only thing that gets anything moving. Like, we're having Oklahoma State where Chuba Hubbard, you know, sent those tweets, and then they put out that weird video, and then Hubbard apologized for not coming to Gundy as a man. If he had come to Gundy and not come to the world, wouldn't nothing happen? It just wouldn't.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
Completely agree on that. Talking to Bomani Jones, host of the Right Time with Bomani Jones podcast that you can get wherever you get your podcast. Bomani, big picture, and you and I exchanged a couple of tweets on this yesterday. Has everything we've seen in the last couple months, especially around players using their voices on social media, have we maybe overstated how much power that gives players now? I mean, where are they at still with their ability to affect change with that as a tool now?
Oh, yeah, we've totally overstated it, because when you think about it, everything that we've seen players use their quote-unquote power to get is like for dignity. It's like for basic stuff. Like something, a point I always make about the civil rights movement is that as momentous and important as it was, when you really go back and look at what people were fighting for, it was stuff they were already supposed to get. Like, power gets things that's a little bit beyond what they quote-unquote deserve. Everybody deserves basic dignity. Everybody deserves to be treated right by their coaches and the people who are around them. And that is what the players are fighting for at every turn here, is really the basic concept of dignity. And so I think for us as observers, if we start talking about, hey, the players got this power to make this happen and now they're using it, well, number one, it kind of gives the implication that when they're treated badly, they could change it, but they don't. So it's almost like kind of sort of what they want. Like, we wind up in that place. And I also think that number two, when we talk about them having that power, it makes us feel better about the fact that we know that fundamentally a lot of what goes on around this game is just wrong. Like, we know a lot of what goes on around college sports just doesn't pass the smell test. And so when the guys come up and do something to get something a little better, we're like, yeah, good for them. When the truth is, we should be the ones fighting for those things for them in reality. Like, as observers and as media, I think we have a certain level of responsibility to, like, oversee the fairness of what goes on. And what we have is just wildly unfair.
And I think, as especially both of us here on the set, former players that were on the other side of that, where it's so normalized for so long, it is eye-opening to get that 30,000-foot view of things and to see it with a little more information and perspective here now. Bomani, one of the other things that
about both of you, though, when you talk about that, and I think this is an important distinction. I was talking to a college football coach about this yesterday. You guys went to one of the schools that actually cares about whether their players learn things, you know, like go to class, get degrees. But that's a big thing. Like, it's, you know, you want the guys to be treated fairly no matter what. But, like, it's one thing at a place where you feel pretty confident that the school is going to make sure that academically you get something out of the deal by the time you get out of there. These other places, like at Iowa, the black graduation rate was 40%, while the white graduation rate of those players was 80%.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a gross, and in the Big Ten, I believe that was the largest disparity in the conference. There was a ton with that, and you're right, Bomani, especially when the sham that is amateurism is built on the promise of an education that most of these places don't even sniff delivering on, it makes the whole thing even a bit more of a farce than a lot of these other things that we have described in that. Bomani Jones with us here on Golic and Wingo. Bo, one other thing that I wanted to get you on while we had you here. Yesterday saw a Twitter exchange back and forth between Mark Cuban and Ted Cruz surrounding a tweet about the anthem that was sent to Mark Cuban in this one. And it seems in general we're getting an uptick in politicians taking their shots at the world of sports with things like this. But this seemed like a pretty high-profile matchup here.
Yeah, it did. It's a high-profile matchup, but, like, this is a statement that I can offer absent of politics. Like, this is just from everything I've gathered, and I know enough people to feel confident saying this. Man, people do not like Ted Cruz, right? Like, it does not you are not a hero for engaging in a public battle with Ted Cruz, because even the people who are on Ted Cruz's same side, don't like Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is from Houston like me, and I'm not really rocking with Ted Cruz. Not because of his politics, but just because of his Ted Cruz. And so when Cruz jumps into something like this, it's an easy fight to decide that you're going to go back and forth with him. And I think for Cuban, in a lot of ways, it was a bit of an easy fight to go back and forth with that talk show host who, you know, came on and said that if guys are kneeling, then so forth and so on and everything else. Like, all that stuff those guys were having back and forth is kind of a like, yeah, that's cool, I get you. But it feels real diversionary in a lot of ways that we are going in these other directions. Like, I'm supposed to talk to Cuban about this and haven't gotten around to it, but for all this stuff that Cuban's saying now, this is also the dude who 6 years ago said that he would cross the street from a black kid in a hoodie the same way he would a white dude with tattoos. I'm like, damn, he got to get tattoos on his face, and all I got to do is keep my ears warm? Like, that's the only thing? Like, I would like to hear more from Mark Cuban about his journey to getting to the place where he is right now on these issues than either one of them getting into a grandstanding fight on Twitter that ultimately won't do nothing.
And I think with Mark Cuban, in a lot of senses, I think that people would have a lot of questions about that in light of what's happened in Washington, right, the recent comparisons to what happened with the Mavericks franchise there as well. Download, subscribe to the Right Time podcast with Bomani Jones wherever you get your podcast. Bo, we always appreciate the time, man.
No problem, man. You guys be good.
Golic.
I tell you what, a great sports night last night, yeah. No doubt about it.
And Wingo.
What a day, what a show, what a time.
Brian, a lot made right now. The NBA announced, in addition to the great testing numbers that we'll get to in a second from yesterday, also that when it comes to the awards for the NBA, that the MVP, Defensive Player of the Year, all these other things will be based on this portion of the season that was already played, meaning the final eight games leading up to the playoff seeding won't be tallied into that. You were pretty adamant that this is already Giannis's award to win. For people that maybe have, you know, already lost what we saw from the early portion of this season, what about Giannis's year makes this just such a no-brainer?
Yeah, there's two reasons why I say that. Number one, there was some pretty effective straw polling done right before the shutdown by some places, including Tim Bontemps at ESPN. And the voters, the actual real people who would vote, were overwhelmingly in favor of Giannis. So part of that is me just saying that I am aware of what the voters are thinking. It's not even just an opinion. I'm just telling you which way I think it's going to go. I suppose things could have changed in 4 months, but LeBron's case hasn't improved. The other thing is Giannis is having a historically great season. And I understand why LeBron himself is a little bit frustrated, and he's been frustrated about the MVP vote consistently over the last 6 or 7 years. But there were times when LeBron won the MVP vote where guys behind him had seasons that would have been MVP years at other eras and other times, even in these years since. And LeBron was just great, especially those years in Miami. I mean, the last year he won the MVP, go look at the season that Kevin Durant had, and Durant couldn't break through because LeBron was just so great. His last MVP award was probably the total height of his powers. And so when you look at LeBron's season, it is very strong. And I compliment him on his defense. This is the best defense LeBron, I think, has played in about 6 or 7 years. But when you go look at Giannis, when you look at his numbers, when you look at his numbers versus his minutes per game, and then you also consider that he is probably going to be the defensive player of the year for a team that was on pace or very close to winning 70 games, it's a compelling case, and I think Giannis, my expectation is that Giannis will win it relatively easily.
And you just mentioned he may double dip with the Defensive Player of the Year, you know, over a guy like Anthony Davis. If he gets to that point, Brian, where he wins a second MVP and they happen to win the title this year, does it then become harder for him to win subsequent MVPs?
Yeah, the one thing that you've seen now, so I've been an MVP voter for 17 years, and one thing that you always see, I'd like to think that I haven't fit into this, but, you know, I probably have, is that a lot of times the MVP isn't about just the numbers, it's about the story. Like, for example, LeBron, the year that really irks him he didn't win it was 2011, which was the 1 year out of 5 years he didn't win it when Derrick Rose did. And that year, the Heat were the villain story, and the Bulls were the challenger story. And they won 60 games, and there was the rise of this player from Chicago. And while Rose had a spectacular season, he was also a better story. And so sometimes the storyline makes a difference. Like, I will tell you that Kobe Bryant, the 1 year he won MVP, which was in 2008, he shouldn't have won it, in my opinion. That should have been LeBron's first MVP. LeBron, he went 39-9 or 38-8 that year and carried the team to 45 wins. But Kobe had been denied the previous couple of years when he should have won it, but the story was better that year. So if you are, especially if Giannis doesn't win, I would say, and he will be viewed through the lens of, well, you've done well in the regular season but haven't delivered in the playoffs, I do think it will become harder for him because, and this happened to LeBron a little bit, you don't just compete with your other opponents who are next to you. You also compete with yourself from the past.
Talking to Brian Windhorst, our ESPN NBA insider with us. Brian, I'm curious in that regard too, and LeBron brought this up himself, and Kendrick Perkins brought this up yesterday too. Is there a reason that we're not doing the Eastern Conference slander with Giannis at the top of his game right now the way it always happened for LeBron?
Well, I mean, let's just... LeBron doesn't go to 8 straight finals if he's in the Western Conference. That's not an insult to LeBron. That's just true. I mean, 3 of those years he was in Cleveland and made it to the finals, they did not beat the Warriors, which means that they would not have gotten out of the West. So LeBron's greatness and his portfolio, LeBron's greatness is not affected by being in the East, but his portfolio is affected having been in the East. And I will say that the first year LeBron went to the West, he did not make the playoffs. Now, he did have an injury, for sure, but, you know, because it is more challenging. So LeBron has a point there, but just because that's true doesn't take away from the great season that Giannis had, just like the 4 times LeBron won MVP in the East. By the way, in years where the East was nowhere near as competitive as it was this year, the East is way deeper, in my opinion, over the last few years than it was for most of LeBron's career. It doesn't take away from the season that Giannis had. And again, this happens every single year, especially when you have tight MVP races, which we don't always have. And again, I do not expect this to be a tight race. Saying that somebody is the second best player, or I shouldn't even say the second best player, because I think LeBron's still the best player, but saying that he had the second best season is not an insult. Saying that I'm voting for you number 2 on the ballot out of 450 players is not dragging you down. I know it's perceived that way, and that's fine, but part of the reason that the media does this is because they have to be the ones to say, hey, we have an all-time great player here, but he's going to go second on my ballot because the other guy had a better season.
Brian, no doubt the testing is working in the bubble as we talk about that, and then back onto the court. 346 players in the league's bubble were tested, and there were no negatives as opposed to last time, 322 and 2 negative or 2 positive tests, and they weren't even yet inside the bubble. So that's all working well. We're finally getting to games, and with the 8 regular season games, and we're talking about LeBron and we're talking about Giannis, would you be shocked if they played all 8 games? I mean, I think they would probably play to get warm a little bit, but then you would see him sitting much of this, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, LeBron has long talked about wanting to play. He's sort of done a shift as people have pulled back and taken games off. LeBron has played more. And I think one of the reasons he's felt the need to do that is because he feels like when he comes to, you know, a city one night in a year that a fan may have bought tickets and driven 3 hours, he doesn't want to let that fan down. He has talked about that a lot. Well, there's no fans here. And again, the television viewers will get to see him plenty. So I would expect that he would not play all 8 games. I'll be interested to see how many games Kawhi plays. You know, Kawhi is really focused on saving up his energy and has no problem with, I have no idea how many he's going to play. I do think that there could be a benefit to some teams who've had some continuity. Let me just bring up 2 teams where I think continuity could be really interesting. One is the Toronto Raptors, who have, as far as I know, avoided anybody getting sick and have been practicing together every day since late June because they had to clear out of Canada and they didn't want to worry about getting across the border. And they went to Naples and started their own bubble several weeks in advance. They are churning along championship DNA. They don't have Kawhi, but I don't think you're going to see a lot of guys resting for them. I think you're going to see them power through, and that could make a difference while these other stars are going to rest. And I want to point out Oklahoma City Thunder in the West. Again, as far as I'm fairly confident, none of their players have tested positive. They've had their whole group, and they have Chris Paul, who's leading the charge. And so while I'm going to sit here and say I understand if Kawhi takes off three of the seeding games because, you know, they're not going to probably catch the Lakers, if LeBron takes off a game or two or Anthony Davis takes off a game or two, the Lakers have lost several players. They're bringing in new players. The Clippers are down, I think, three players. At least one of them has said it's due to the virus. The other ones, we don't know for sure, but you can make a reasonable guesstimation. I think that there may be some value in establishing some continuity in those eight games, even if some of the stars skip that, saving for the playoffs.
Plenty of great stuff to keep an eye on in that regard as we get ready for the ramp up here, the pre-bubble bubble working out perchance for the Toronto Raptors. You can follow him on Twitter at WindhorseESPN. Brian, thank you for the time as always.
Thanks, Brian.
Congrats to the Golic family. Have a great weekend.
Golic and Wingo.
It was all sort of one big giant jello mold. Very interesting where that went.
Delighted now to be joined by our ESPN NFL analyst, Booger McFarland, with us here on Golic and Wingo. Booger, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good, fellas. How y'all doing?
Have you been on the bike yet this morning or no? Is that an afternoon thing?
No, I have about another 15 minutes of commitments, and then I'm jumping on the bike. But I do have my biking shorts on. Golic, I thought of you this morning as I was putting them on and knowing that I was coming on here. These shorts seem like it would be something that you would have worn back in the day because it's got like this huge pad that kind of runs up the center area, if you know what I mean, and it makes the bike seat a little bit more comfortable.
Well, I needed anything on my backside to make it look like I had more of a butt because I had a really flat butt, so that would have helped me.
Yeah, classic case of pancake booty here in the Golic house with this one. So trying to stay safe is kind of the theme of all of this, Booger. And we saw a lot of big news from the NFL yesterday on the NFL offering the players zero preseason games, the talk of daily testing for the first 2 weeks of camp. Overall, was this a win for the players in this?
Yeah, I think it was a win. I would just love to know what the players gave up because you and I both know the owners aren't just going to give up no preseason games and testing for nothing. So I think the players came out with the social media push on Sunday. We want to play. We want to play and make the conditions safe. And the owners said, okay, we'll do that. We're going to test every day for the first couple of weeks. You don't want any preseason games? Fine. No preseason games. But I think on the back end, I'm really interested to see what was the negotiating chip that they had to push to the table to get the things that they wanted.
Booger, I'm wondering now, just speak specifically for you, the football player. No preseason games. How do you feel about that? What did you think of those, and do you like those when you had to play in them?
No, I didn't. And I truly think that for an offensive and defensive lineman, I think it's different. Mikey, and both of you guys know this. When we go 9-on-7, which is inside run drill, that's pretty much live. So we're going live every day. Now, do you need to get the tempo or the rhythm of a game? Okay, maybe so. But as a defensive tackle, I didn't really need preseason, man, because 9-on-7 was live every single day. Goal line drill, I mean, we did that live. So I think the preseason is a bit overrated. And I know from a monetary standpoint, all the players earn the same amount of money in the preseason. So it's not like you're getting any financial incentive to play preseason games. And I think if you were to canvass the NFL, a large percentage of the players would rather not play preseason games at all.
Yeah, completely. You know, I guess there was part of me, Booger, that missed. While you said 9-on-7 is live, nobody's cutting you. There were. I always thought I needed at least one to kind of get every facet of the game and hit it. Because as hard as we go in practice, I just never think it matches fully, you know, someone going for my knees, you know, not in an illegal way, but a cut block, just something that can go on in a regular game. Either way, players have to learn how to be a little, you know, it's going to be a little different. Do you think there is an advantage to one group of players or a disadvantage to another group of players with less preparation?
Well, I think the guys that have to do a lot of thinking in their job, i.e. quarterbacks, i.e. offensive personnel that may have to do some site adjustments, because those things you have to do under the gun. Let's not forget, what is the play clock? 40 seconds. So when that play comes in, by the time you get it, you're only going to have, 19, 20 seconds when you get to the line of scrimmage. So their time is of the essence for you to process information quickly, for you to disperse that information, and for everybody to be on the same page. And you only get that under the gun in the game. You can try to replicate that practice with the clock and everything, but you only get it under the gun in the game. And so I think there's a disadvantage to that group of people. As far as players that are reactionary players, like defensive guys, I think we have an advantage, because a lot of what we do is predicated based on us being aggressive or us reacting to what the offense does. So offense is always going to be behind. Golic, you've heard this before. Defense is usually going to be ahead of the offense in spring practice, and it's going to be the same way when the NFL season starts if they have no preseason games.
So, and again, the lesser the athlete you are, the tougher it is. So O-line's going to struggle, right, Mike?
Yeah, no, let's all get your jokes in now. We all saw the same D-tackle get reached yesterday on Twitter in that video of the Packers offensive line. We all know where the real athletes lies. We talked to ESPN football analyst Booger McFarland with us this morning. Booger, I'm curious with this one as well. Going into camp this year, it's going to be shortened, which means it's going to be a lot tougher scenario for the young players on the team. How do you think coaches are going to have to approach this as far as not only trying to figure out, all right, what do I have on the entirety and the depth of my roster, but also in getting some of their young, high-profile guys ready?
Well, I think the guys that are in the first, second, third round, young guys that are high draft picks, those guys are going to be expected to be ready. I think it's going to be a huge disadvantage for your mid to late round picks, undrafted free agents, guys that need reps, guys that need to find a niche, what they can play on, special teams, I think are going to struggle. I think your high-end guys, man, guys like Joe Burrow, Patrick Queen, CeeDee Lamb, like your upper echelon guys, those guys are going to be fine because of their talent and because I think being assimilated into the systems, and the system is going to be made easier for them. Those guys on the back end, I think, are going to struggle because you need to go out there and go, like, you need to go out there and impress the coaches. You need to find a way or something where you can impress a coach. And a lot of times you do it in practice, but you really catch their eye in a game under the gun because there's nothing like real live bullets being flown. So the high-end guys will be fine, but overall, guys, I do think your back end of the roster, your free agents, your special teams are going to struggle early on.
How much more injury are you expecting this preseason and season because of the late start and how it's all working?
You know, I don't really think we're going to have a lot of injuries. You know, if we look at football and how things have progressed over the years with medicine and training, I mean, think about this. You know, when Reggie White was coming out of Tennessee, I mean, he was looked at as an athletic freak. I mean, a guy 300 pounds that could run 4.6 in the 40. Like, we have a lot of those guys now. Like, training has changed. The athlete has changed. And I do think with all the way the guys take care of their body, with Tom Brady and everybody eating right, and Cam Newton is now a vegan, better him than me, and all these different things that are going on, like, nobody really is not taking care of their body. So I think when guys get to camp, you're going to see, I think, a full-speed NFL training camp, guys are going to be running and playing to their full capability. Now, it's going to be up to the coaches, I think, to rein them in a little bit, because guys are going to be chomping at the bit. We haven't practiced in a long time. We want to go out and show you I'm still the man. I think coaches have to rein them in a little bit and kind of protect them from themselves.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, having to kind of pull them back. We've seen players itching to get back. We've seen the guys like Tom Brady and company going out and holding those team workouts, even as NFL doctors have advised them not to in all of this one. And Booger, that kind of leads back to the testing portion of all of this. The NFL announced testing daily for the first 2 weeks of camp. And then after that 5% positivity rate threshold, where as long as they're under that for a team, they'll start testing every other day. And I'm curious, because we've seen it work so well in the NBA, do you think the NFL is going to hold fast to that as a player? Would you be comfortable not being tested every day, knowing you're leaving, you're going home to your family in this time?
Well, I do think that they may have to adjust that, because think about this: during training camp, we're usually all staying together, right, at a hotel or dorm or something like that. I haven't seen the final living arrangement, but usually that's what training camp is about. So I'm going to test you for the first couple weeks during training camp while we're all together. Then once training camp breaks and I go back home and everybody's living in different houses based on whether the positive rate is low or not, now the environment has changed. So no longer are we living in a hotel. We are living in different houses. I honestly think that the testing should be different. And here's what I mean by that. You don't necessarily have to test guys as much when you're all in the same setting as far as a hotel. I think the testing should really ramp up when guys go back to their individual homes and they're living with their individual family, because then I think you're more likely to get a spike than you would if we're kind of in that quarantine bubble-like hotel situation.
You can always check him out across the ESPN platforms. He is our ESPN football analyst, Booger McFarland. Booger, we appreciate the time and perspective this morning, man.
Anytime. I'll take it easy.
Golic and Wingo.
Let's not expect too much. There's only one person out there that's expecting way too much out of this guy too early. We know who that is. It's his father.
We're delighted to be joined by Cleveland Indians manager Terry Francona. Terry, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, guys. How you doing?
Doing well.
Great. Doing great. Thank you. And before we get to a lot of the baseball that we've got coming up here, we know this had been a discussion that had taken place a little while ago here, and we just played some of it back there in the open. Discussions around your team specifically and the things going on with the look at the name changes surrounding nicknames in Native Americans in sports. You had come out as these conversations had come to the forefront and said you would support a change in all this. I saw your son Nick wrote a piece for GQ saying that should be the start of all this. So I'm curious right now, as we get ready to get back going in baseball, where those conversations around the Indians nickname are with Cleveland and the franchise.
Well, they're actually pretty prevalent, you know, in inside our doors, and they've been for some time. You know, I think my point was, is that we have people inside our organization that I think are capable of leading, not necessarily following. And that was the point I was trying to make. You know, there's a lot that goes into things that I know I usually oversimplify things. And that's not always the best way to do it. It's just the way my brain works. But I think like I was trying to intimate that we have people that can lead. And that's the hope.
What it always gets interesting is you're being a face of a team, being the manager, much like Ron Rivera is all of a sudden, you know, comes over from Carolina and here he is in the midst of something like that and all else going on, and you as well in Cleveland, just like at the Atlanta Braves, Florida State as well. It's interesting where this may go, so we hope to see progress there. As far as baseball, I mean, It is time to actually manage some games here starting pretty soon. And I wonder from your side of it, the strategy side of it, normally the marathon 162, now 60 games. Does that make you manage differently in the beginning of the season?
Mike, I think, one, the game is the game. So the game doesn't get played differently. But I think you need to recognize that there are 60 games. So, you know, I'm saying I don't know that you necessarily do a lot of things differently because, again, you got to play the game right. And that's the hope, is if you play the game right, you have the talent that'll get you where you need to go. But I think recognizing that is like, you know, we've been known to get off to some slow starts while I've been in Cleveland. You know, a slow start could be the end. So we need to recognize that.
And certainly, those are going to be the challenges on the field, but we know managing this year is also going to be managing everything that goes on with your team relative to this pandemic. It's not a bubble, and so you're going to have players going home. And so I'm curious, I know you guys had an issue early in camp and had to levy a bit of a punishment there, but what's the conversation like with your players now about their responsibility away from the park?
Well, just to be clear, it wasn't punishment. It was just precautionary. We just wanted to make sure that something didn't happen that shouldn't. I want to make sure that's clear.
Sure.
It was okay. In no way punishment. And what I think we're hoping is that because of the group we have, we can actually turn it into a competitive advantage. Now, I think every team's probably trying to do the same thing. But if we take care of each other, you know, again, that's first and foremost, because there's some guys, myself included, you know, a little bit older, maybe have some underlying health concerns. And then there's people at home that have babies and wives, and, you know, so we got to take care of that. But I think if you do that, you also take care of your players. And the more guys you can keep on the field, the better your chances are.
How much has that become a normal part now of your words to your team? Whatever your normal words are when they leave, you know, the facility, have they now added and make sure you take the proper precautions? How have you dealt with that?
Our organization has done such a good job of when guys reported to camp, explaining things to them and not just hoping they understood, but taking the time to go over it. The hardest thing, Mike, is really not being able to talk to the guys so much. You know, up until yesterday, our guys were dressing all over the ballpark, in the visiting clubhouse, in the media room, in the, you know, if you tried to find a player, you had to get a map. Now we're gravitating more towards our side of the clubhouse, and we're still using other rooms. But at least I know pretty much where everybody is. So our one-on-one time, or even our time to meet as a team, is drastically reduced. So you try to rely on everything we believe in and hope that carries the day.
Talking to Terry Francona with us, Cleveland Indians manager here on Golic and Wingo, Mike Golic Jr. In today on the show. And Terry, one of the other big conversations around Major League Baseball has been what's going on with the Toronto Blue Jays right now. Not allowed to play in their home stadium because of everything going on between Canada and the United States with this virus. And I was just curious. There's a lot of relationships in the Blue Jays building that have roots in Cleveland there. There's certainly proximity that's in their favor. Has there been any talk as they look for relief or aid somewhere of Cleveland being a potential place that might be able to help Toronto out when it comes to this?
Not to my knowledge. And I think part of that is because if you look at the schedule, some of the carryover of, you know, I think it almost needs to be a National League team. I believe, just to make the schedule work. You're right, we do have some pretty close friends up there, and, you know, Mark and Ross, but I don't believe so. And again, I shouldn't speak out of turn because I don't know everything, but I think they've been actually looking like at Pittsburgh, and I know they were looking at Buffalo, their AAA facility. I'll tell you what, you know, it seems like in today's environment, at every turn you turn around, there's another challenge in front of you. I can't imagine what they're dealing with, you know, with not knowing where they're going to play next week. That's got to be a tremendous headache.
Yeah, you're not kidding. In a season already full of curveballs, they're getting one that's really dropping off the table.
That's true.
This. As far as, you know, in mine and Mike's sport of football, a lot of times at the beginning you see the defense can be a little ahead of the offense for various reasons. And in baseball, I'm sure it has those same tendencies for one to have an advantage over the other. Has that changed because of the shortness of the season and the preparation, or who has the advantage coming out of the gate?
That's a great question, and that's something we've kind of been monitoring ourselves. Now, the real season hasn't started yet. Regardless of whether there's fans in the stands, when the bell rings, the game is different, and we all know that. But I've been surprised in our inter-squad games. I thought pitching would just dominate our own hitters, because everybody knows your own hitters don't like facing your own pitchers. And our guys, to their credit, they've given really quality at-bats and actually hit the ball pretty good. You know, it's funny because on one hand, you're happy the hitters are hitting, and then you look up and you're like, well, wait a minute, there are pitchers. So you talk about the glass always being half full or half empty. It's that way every single night.
It really is. So depending on how you want to look at that, always the double-edged sword of trying to evaluate in that situation. And I'm curious, as we're talking to Terry Francona here with us, evaluation during this time period is going to be difficult. And you have the trade deadline coming up a lot sooner than in the past and all this because of the accordion season on this. Obviously, there's always the rumors around Francisco Lindor. But just in general, how are you guys approaching the trade deadline and the factor that's going to be in a shortened season?
Oh, my goodness. Well, one, you need to talk to Chris and Cherney about that. That's above my pay grade, and I'm glad it is. The way we're approaching it is we want to win, and that'll never change. you know, again, regardless of what our payroll is or how many fans are in the stands or how many games we're playing, if there's a game to be played, we want to win. And that's, you know, that's the way we're built, and that's the way it will always stay.
Great stuff to hear, and certainly looking forward as baseball continues to return to play. Terry Francona, Indians manager, with us here this morning. Terry, we really appreciate the time.
Thanks, Tito.
Guys, thanks. I appreciate it. Take care, okay? See ya.
This has been the Best of Golic and Wingo podcast. You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or just ask your smart speaker to play Golic and Wingo. Plus, you can check the guys out live weekday mornings from 6 to 10 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on ESPN News.